I'd like to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have several cases that are going to be argued, and there will be changes of panels, so we will take a break after the first argument today and reconstitute and come back in with a different panel for the second argument. It's my understanding, though, as far as the first argument is concerned, that the attorneys have all checked in. Before we begin the argument, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Wade Birdwell, and to my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Sutterth. Again, welcome. Would the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call Texas RR LLC, DBA, Renew Home Health et al. Versus Maxim Healthcare Partners LLC. May it please the court, Ms. Michelle R. Merriam will argue for the appellant. Mr. Michael Anderson will argue for the
appellee. You may proceed.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Michelle Merriam, and I represent the four appellates in this case. We ask that you reverse the judgment below, render judgment that Maxis take nothing on its claims, and remand with instructions to award attorney's fees to BP Cheney and to Texas RHH as the prevailing parties under their respective contracts. In my limited time before the court, I will address the reasons for reversal of the three largest damage awards in the judgment. Namely, one, the separate awards of $2.3 million against Misty Brady for fraud and against Texas RHH for breach of contract. Two, the award of nearly $1 million in escrow directly to Maxis. And three, the separate awards of $250,000 against Texas RHH and Zira based on the purported value of Zira's Medicare provider number. If the panel has no specific questions, we will stand on the arguments in our briefs for the remaining issues, including the recovery of attorney's fees and the trial court's violation of the double recovery rule by awarding Maxis the same damages for the same injury in at least four different instances. Turning to the first issue, the judgment awards $2.3 million against both Brady and Texas RHH based on the difference between the purchase price of $8.8 million for the assets and the purported fair market value of those assets. The fraud judgment and the breach of contract judgment are both based on representations contained in the contract in sections 216 and 217 concerning the accuracy of financial information that was provided during due diligence and the existence or non-existence of a tax liability at the time of closing. There are two reasons that I will discuss why these judgments should be reversed. First, that this is simply not a fraud case. Second, that Maxis sustained no injury and no recoverable damages. This is not a fraud case. We agree with the principle that Maxis cites in its brief and that this court discussed in the Alexander case, that in general, an agent of a company can be held liable for her own fraudulent statements. However, that common law principle has not only been qualified but expressly preempted by statute. In section 21.223 of the Texas Business Organizations Code, the Texas legislature has decided that the owner of an LLC, such as Misty Brady, cannot be held liable for actual or constructive fraud based on or for any actions relating to or arising from the contractual obligations of the entity, such as Texas RHH, unless the plaintiff, Maxis, proves and submits that the owners committed the fraud for her own personal benefit.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, if it's true, accepting the appellee's view, that one of the motivations for this was to get money to pay off the IRS tax lien and penalties and interest, wouldn't Ms. Brady have been personally on the hook for those amounts had they not been paid?
That is a technical possibility, but that does not actually establish direct personal benefit, and that issue was not submitted to the jury.
Why doesn't it establish direct personal benefit if she was on the hook for it?
Because there was no evidence submitted that she was actually going to be criminally liable or personally liable for that amount. In fact, the evidence shows that she had been working with the IRS for over a year. Texas RHH was current on all of its taxes owed for 2012, and that in only a matter of a few months, if she had retained the assets or sold them to a different company after the letter of intent expired, Texas RHH was in a position to generate the revenue to pay off those amounts. But what's important here is that Maxis did not submit because it does not believe that that statute applies. It absolutely does apply because all of the evidence that Maxis relies on for breach against Texas RHH is identical to the evidence it relies on to establish fraud against Misty Brady. In fact, sections 216 and 217 are contractual representations. By representing the existing state of facts or the accuracy of information that was provided during due diligence, they kind of incorporate a fraud type analysis into the contract analysis. In order to show that 216 is breached, Maxis had to show that the financial information was inaccurate, was misleading, i.e. that the tax liability was not disclosed. That is the crux of its case for fraud as well.
I have a question. I know that your position is that Maxis was just buying assets, and so the tax liabilities were totally immaterial to the valuation or anything, so why not disclose them?
They were, in fact, disclosed.
Well, if you squint, perhaps, a little bit, do you really think that on the financials that were given to Maxis, that the exact nature of what was out there in terms of the penalties and interest and the amounts and everything were disclosed?
You are correct, Your Honor, that the penalties and interest were not included in the exact amount, but the very first document that Misty Brady provided in September disclosed a nearly $2 million tax liability.
But it just was referred to as net debt, correct?
Actually, in that document, that was the cost reports, Plaintiff's Exhibit 68 in Volume 27 of the record. It actually identifies a $1.9 million quote, payroll tax liability.
Well, it shows that that's due. It doesn't show whether it's paid or unpaid.
Actually, even more important, it says it's a promissory note, which would suggest that, in fact, the payroll taxes had already been paid by use of a loan, and there was a promissory note outstanding. So if you go look at it, it says promissory note dash payroll taxes underneath the debts owed. So anybody looking at that, including me, would go, gee, they must have paid the payroll tax, but they got a loan to do it.
Well, respectfully, any business that is willing to pay $8.8 million for assets and actually truly believes that outstanding tax liabilities for which it will never be responsible, because under the agreement it signs, it will never be responsible. In fact, they are excluded liabilities expressly. And Texas RHH would owe indemnity if they ever were responsible, which they weren't. If that truly was material, then it was incumbent upon Maxis to ask more questions.
But wasn't it also the case that, I mean, you know, maybe Maxis should have asked more questions and maybe you're satisfied that your clients disclosed it adequately, but if they're immaterial, why even make any representations in the APA about the status of taxes? I mean, why is that representation even in there if Maxis is never going to be on the hook for it?
Because there are certain instances that did not occur here where if the payroll tax liability had existed at closing, which it did not, if it had followed the assets, which it did not, then the IRS could have continued to levy the income generated on those assets. And so Maxis wanted a representation in there that there was no liability so that it could be insured that it would not have to suffer any
losses. What would have happened if the closing date had come and gone and for some reason the money didn't arrive in time, or the $3 million that Ms. Brady used to pay off the IRS, something went wrong with that? I mean, I'm having trouble understanding why the representation was true on the day of closing.
It was true on the day of closing because it was also true when the agreement was actually signed, and that's very important. But if, as Maxis argues in its brief, negotiations were still ongoing, the document was being finalized at the time that the tax liability was paid off. If Maxis had wired the money, the liability had been paid off, and then for some reason the deal didn't go through, then Ms. Brady possibly would have owed the money.
Possibly?
Well, in that case, yes, she would have owed the money back.
Back to Maxis?
Yes, certainly would have.
And how would she have gotten that money back to Maxis?
Well, she would have still had the assets. So like I said before, the revenue generated on the assets could have generated the money to pay Maxis
back. You think Maxis would have understood that when it had no idea this was going on?
Well, that would be a different case. At the end of the day here, this is simply not a fraud case first, because Misty Brady cannot be held liable for fraud based on contractual representations that Texas RHH made.
And you think that's good? You think that's good law even for fraud in the inducement?
I do, exactly. This is in the Supreme Court's case, Formosa Plastics. It discusses how an individual can't, or how fraud can be based on duties that arise independent of the contract. But Formosa Plastics concerned promissory fraud, a promise with no intention to perform. Here, Texas RHH is the only one making promises, and an essential element of any fraudulent inducement claim is the existence of a contract between the parties. Ms. D. Brady was not a party to these provisions of the contract, therefore cannot be held liable for fraudulent inducement in any event. But at the end of the day, for either fraudulent inducement or fraud or breach of contract, Maxis suffered no damages. The judgment's award of $2.3 million was based on the purported fair market value of the assets, not just the assets, but also including the liabilities. But the correct measure of damages is the natural and foreseeable consequence of the existence of the tax liability. Maxis never bargained for paying fair market value. It bargained for paying $8.8 million.
And if I were, you know, not to get into the different accounting principles and damages models and all that, but just as a blanket proposition, would you agree that if you were looking to buy even the assets of a business, that you would have a lot more satisfaction, that you were paying a correct amount if you were assured that the value that's being reflected on the books was not somehow affected by payroll taxes not being paid on time and accumulating? I mean, wouldn't that affect value?
It would affect the value of the company as a whole, yes. It would not affect the value of the assets. And in fact, Maxis argues over and over again that the reason its expert valued the company as a whole was that goodwill takes account of the revenue-generating potential of the company. Well, revenue-generating potential has nothing to do with liabilities. In fact, if you look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 219, which are the November financials that were provided just prior to the closing date, the first page of that has the revenue on which the purchase price was based and the EBITDA on which the purchase price was based, the earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization, which was $2.2 million on that document. Misty Brady and Texas RHH asked for $8.8 million, and Maxis agreed because Maxis wanted to close the deal. If Maxis truly cared about the fair market value of the company or the fair market value of the assets, it could have hired somebody to actually audit the records of the company, which it knew had never been conducted. In fact, Fortech had only been hired to get the records in order, not to conduct a huge audit. And Formosa Plastics actually addresses this question as well. In Formosa Plastics, the plaintiff Presidio claimed damages in the trial court awarded damages based on the bid the contractor claimed it would have made if it had known the truth. And the Texas Supreme Court said that these damages were based on an entirely hypothetical, speculative bargain that was never struck and would not have been consummated. It therefore reversed and remanded there because there was some evidence of recoverable damages.
Okay, I've got a quick question before your time runs out. The record reflects that, in fact, tax liabilities were incurred by Zira after the APA is executed,
while Maxis is performing under the management agreement and before anybody alleges any breach, part of what happens is Medicare comes back and says, oh, by the way, you haven't paid your payroll taxes, Zira, so we're going to take away income that we would ordinarily be paying for your Medicare patients. We're going to put a lien on that. We're going to, I believe it was $27,000, and said that's what we're going to ultimately of something like $90,000. Okay?
Correct.
We have evidence of that. What we don't have is we don't have any evidence, because there's no disclosure of the lien with regard to Maxis's, I mean, with regard to the LLC's outstanding tax deal, tax liabilities. There's a lien, there are liens, there's interest, and there's penalties. None of those are disclosed. And the assumption of your argument with regard to, well, we paid everything off, there's no damages, is you didn't really need to disclose any of that, when in fact, it appears that in fact, Medicare doesn't have to look to Ms. Brady for the tax payment, does it?
I do not know the answer to that question.
Okay, so if in fact she doesn't pay it, all of a sudden Maxis is operating the LLC and they start getting shorted by Medicare on the very patients they've just purchased because the tax liability has not been paid, just like what happened with Zira, and that's not disclosed anywhere. That possibility is not even come remotely disclosed.
In fact, Your Honor, that possibility is disclosed because the remittance advices, which were in the Kinzer account that Maxis had unrestricted access to, show on a daily basis a 15% levy since 2010 being attached to the assets, to all income being generated on a daily basis from Texas RHH. Ms. King testified that she reviewed those remittance advices, but that she did not understand the term, the code LE or the code LU,
I misspoke, I said lien, levy.
Yeah. But in a levy only exists if there is a lien, and she also admitted that, so she would have understood that. And that's exactly the difference here between Texas RHH and Zira. Zira had a lien. Ms. Brady did not realize that there were payroll taxes or taxes owed at the time of the agreement, but that's besides the point. With Zira, Maxis did suffer some injury. The question there is just whether it's recoverable under the contract. Here, with Texas RHH, Maxis suffered no injury because it never paid penalties, it never paid interest, it never had any liens assessed against it, it never paid a dime to the IRS, and that evidence is undisputed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you add 2 minutes to their time, please?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Michael Anderson on behalf of the Appalee, Maxis Healthcare Partners, LLC. This is a case, it's a textbook case of fraud. The evidence in the record completely supports that. It's also a case where there are breaches of sections 2.16 related to the financial information of Texas RHH, and section 2.17 that regards not only taxes but liens and also whether or not there are any prior material deficiencies. The evidence in the record fully supports the final judgment's finding that there was fraud on behalf of Ms. Brady. I want to address, in the first instance, this notion that Ms. Brady is somehow shielded from fraud liability under the Texas Business Organizations Code. The law in Texas, as this court recognized in the Alexander opinion, has long been that an agent of an employer is always liable for his or her own tortious conduct. That is the law. The Texas Business Organizations Code that's relied upon by Ms. Brady to escape fraud liability is the law that got put in place on alter ego liability. For example, here, if there were multiple members of the LLC and someone other than Ms. Brady who was not involved in the fraud and wrongdoing, that other person would not be liable for fraud simply because Ms. Brady committed the fraud. Instead, under the Texas Business Organizations Code at issue, it would be that person would be liable if the LLC was used as an artifice for fraud, if it was used to perpetrate a fraud.
So do you think it would be all right? I mean, let's say we reform and everybody goes on their merry way. Would you be looking to collect $2.3 million from Texas RHH and another $2.3 million from Ms. Brady?
The answer to that would be no. If we recovered it from the first, if we recovered it from Texas RHH first, then I think you would get into a double recovery issue, and I think that's where the question goes. And that's one of their arguments, is that this is an impermissible double recovery in the final judgment. And as the Dally Pena case that we cited from the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, what it held was is that it's the collection, the satisfaction of that judgment has to occur first before the issue of double recovery arises. And so,
but I assume you'd be arguing that it wasn't a double recovery.
If we actually recovered the $2.3 million, then we could not go after and seek to recover again the $2.3 million. But until there's been a satisfaction in the first instance, the issue about double recovery does not apply. Now back to...
So is it your position that the double recovery and the one satisfaction rule are the same rule?
No, Your Honor. The issue that was raised by them, by appellant, was simply that we have two issues of $2.3 million in the final judgment, and we cannot get both.
That's really a one satisfaction rule scenario, isn't it? I mean, double recovery really goes to whether you can get the same amount. You can get two amounts for the same harm.
It's an indivisible injury.
That's right.
Would you agree that the injury that is being compensated for, both as to the breach against the LLC by the LLC and the fraud by Ms. Brady, that's the same injury?
Yes. In fact, it's the same measure of damages as the jury was charged, which was the difference in what was paid in the fair market value. And so the issue then becomes, and you can have different tortfeasors, or here we have different breach, and you can have them liable, but then, as I understood their argument, is that we were impermissibly trying to recover not simply 2.3, but $4.6 million. And that's where, in the Fort Worth Court of Appeals case, it's the satisfaction, which hasn't happened, and that's the issue as framed by the appellant on that point. The issue, the next one is the no injury or damages that was raised by appellant in argument. The issue was, well, we have paid Texas RHH, paid the taxes, Texas RHH paid the penalties, and Texas RHH paid the interest, and therefore no harm, no foul. That misses the point entirely. And what the record reflects is that the financial statements that were provided omitted, particularly if you look at the balance sheet, and it's that was provided in December 2012, it completely omits as a current liability the taxes, penalties, and interest. As a result of that, there are retained earnings and equity that are positive, showing positive growth. As Ms. Brady testified at trial, if you apply the unpaid taxes, penalties, and interest, it would bankrupt Texas RHH and completely wipe out the retained earnings and equity. And then you're looking at purchasing not a company or the assets that are showing net retained earnings going north, positive, and now it's a radically different entity because those assets, the way they were being run, they could not perform under that tax structure in the same manner. In other words, it was now negative. It was in the red if you applied the unpaid taxes, penalties, and interest.
Is there any place in the record that addresses my earlier question to counsel with regard to any limitation of Medicare with regard to who they may look to satisfy the tax levy? In other words, she's making the argument that she's the only one who has to pay the tax levy, but the tax levy against zero would indicate that that is specific to the Medicare patient that's being provided for in some way, shape, or form, and can be assessed against revenue that is incurred after the execution of the APA.
You are absolutely correct, and it is in the record where the provider number, that's the issue. The asset, the provider number, set forth in our brief, where it, the testimony, uncontroverted by both sides, is from Ms. King and also Ms. Brady, is that that Medicare provider number can absolutely be used by Medicare to go get monies that are owed in unpaid taxes, that revenue stream attached to that Medicare provider number. And that is in the record. And I have the record cite, Your Honor. It is volume 10 of the reporter's record at 199. There was also a question posed as far as, and I believe it was you, Justice Kerr, was if the deal fell apart, would Ms. Brady simply pay the money back that she had taken and paid before closing? The testimony in the record was she wouldn't have the money. She did not have it, and she said she would work as hard as she could to somehow come up with the money and pay it off eventually. But to your question, there was testimony directly in the record where she would not have been able to pay back the $3 million. I also want to address the issue as far as personal benefit that led off this afternoon's argument about whether or not Ms. Brady did receive a personal benefit. The testimony, again, in the record from Ms. Brady is that there was a Trust Fund Recovery Act that makes the owner of a company personally liable. We don't have to get into criminal liability, but just civilly, personally liable if you withhold employment taxes and then don't remit those to the federal government. And that's in the record. It's volume 6. At pages 38 through 40. You heard argument today as well about, well, there's no reliance there, and therefore that somehow knocks out the $2.3 million in damages. And I think it's worth addressing here is that reliance isn't an element on the breach of contract. The reliance is the element on the fraud claim, and the evidence supports there's certainly justifiable reliance given the financials provided, given the express representations in the asset purchase agreement. There's definitely reliance.
What about the idea that, is it Ms. King? She was the one conducting due diligence on Maxis's behalf.
Yes.
What about the idea that she didn't really look too closely? She didn't even find out what this LE or LU code was, that she didn't recognize because, as the appellants say, your client really didn't care about any liabilities that might be out there.
My client certainly cared about liabilities, and that's certainly why there were representations being made in the asset purchase agreement. The testimony on this point was that the remittance advices that were sent out simply had a code of LE, and that my client did not understand what LE meant.
Well, why not? I mean, wouldn't somebody ask? If you're doing due diligence, why wouldn't you want to know what that means?
They simply did not know, and the evidence in the records that Maxis was a startup company. Now, Ms. King certainly had experience in the past, but as to why not ask, you have the letter of intent that then goes to the asset purchase agreement, and there are representations being made that there are no tax levies. There are no levies. So you have affirmative representations on that, and it's not a case where...
But you do have a monthly document that's showing a 15% deduction, which clearly affects revenue for the entity that you're seeking to purchase. And so why does that not put a reasonable purchaser on notice to conduct inquiry as to why the revenue is being reduced on a regular basis by that particular amount?
Actually, Justice Birdwell, if you look at the remittance advices, you're not going to see here's where the revenue is and here's now you're getting a haircut of 15%. You just have a number, and then there is a code on the document of LE. There is not on the remittance.
There's not a specific set aside of 15%.
That's right. That's not how it's being reflected on the remittance advice that says it is, hey, this is a levy. We're doing a haircut of 15% off of the revenue.
So it's not the haircut is not itemized.
That is correct.
Okay.
The other issue, as far as back to 2.16 and 2.17, the argument's been made at length that those were all correct and therefore there could be no breach of contract. Well, the evidence in the record, if we want to look at 2.16 first, that is about the financial information that had been provided to my company, Maxis. Ms. Brady acknowledged that the financial information, the unaudited financial statements, were true and accurate, and those were the financial statements contained in Plaintiff's Exhibit 212 at the trial court. And the testimony is not only from Mr. Furtek, but almost universally, that they were not correct. They did not have the tax penalties and interest in there. There's no line item in there for them, certainly not under current liabilities. By their own admission, the financial information representation in 2.16 is false, and it is a breach of contract. The notion on the taxes under Section 2.17, the appellants boil it down to simply, well, we paid on the day of closing, and therefore that representation is true. The problem with that is Section 2.17 is much broader than simply saying no taxes due. Number one, the record reflects that there were Texas Workforce Commission taxes still outstanding. Number two, at the end of paragraph 2.17, there's a representation about no prior material deficiencies. Larry Brown, local Larry Brown tax attorney here, testified, and he had represented Texas RHH, that representation was absolutely false because there had been prior material deficiencies. The other issue were the no levies, and we know now after the fact that there were levies, so it's much broader than simply no taxes were owed. The final point, and I think it's sort of a red herring, but it's addressed, and I want to make sure it's the record straight on this. There was an argument that there was some sort of, by the appellant, that there was some sort of latent ambiguity in connection with closing date and closing under the asset purchase agreement, and that the only thing that mattered was the end of the day, December 31st. Well, closing date is actually defined in the very first paragraph, the very first header paragraph in the asset purchase agreement, and it is December 31st, 2012. Closing is actually defined later in section 1.4 as 11:59 on the 31st. For purposes of the representations and warranties of section 2.16 and 2.17, it's on and as of closing date, not the closing, and I am out of time. And I appreciate your consideration. We ask that this final judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court. In my time on rebuttal, I will address several of the arguments that Appley has raised and the order in which they've raised them. So turning first to the issue of fraud and the application of 21.223, as discussed in our reply brief, this court's opinion in Alexander concerned fraud in the performance of a contract, not fraud prior to the execution of a contract, not fraudulent inducement, and there is no allegation here of fraud in the performance of a contract, so Alexander does not apply. And in fact, this court recognized a distinction between pre-contract and post-contract fraud in that case of Alexander. As for the direct benefit, setting aside the fact that Maxis never submitted that as it would have been required to do, there is simply no evidence that Misty Brady was actually facing personal liability in order to establish that she would personally benefit from committing fraud, which she could not commit anyway under Texas law. The double recovery issue regarding the $2.3 million is the fact that in normal cases where collection is the issue, you have joint tortfeasors. You have joint and several liability, and the doctrine of joint and several liability as incorporated into those judgments prevents the double recovery, because once the judgment is satisfied, the plaintiff cannot collect from the other liable defendant. This is not joint and several liability, and therefore the judgment does not prevent Maxis from collecting twice. Therefore, the judgment is error. Whether Maxis promises not to collect twice or not is irrelevant.
So you're saying that because the 2.3 against the LLC is its several liability, and the 2.3 against Brady is her several liability, and there's no actual provision for joint and several liability between the two.
Correct.
That as a matter of law, they can execute on the several liability against the individually liable defendants.
That is exactly correct. And that's the same problem with the awards of $250,000 against Texas RHH and against Zira. And in fact, Maxis recognizes how this applies because it was forced to make an election in numerous respects. There were other judgments for 2.3, other jury awards for $2.3 million for money hadn't received, for example, that Maxis was forced to elect between. The court's problem here was recognizing how to apply this principle when you have no joint and several liability, but two different defendants under two different theories. And Texas law is clear that that is still an impermissible double recovery, unless there's something in the
judgment
that prevents
it. Can we modify the judgment in some way to take account of the one satisfaction rule with regard to that?
Yes, and we actually requested that that be done and provided some alternatives, and the trial court denied that. But here what's there should simply be no fraud judgment in the first place, which is how we get into this problem and why this problem doesn't arise that frequently, because you don't typically have two judgments of these sorts being awarded. Maxis repeatedly refers to the representations in the agreement as representations by Ms. Brady. They were not representations by Ms. Brady. They were representations by Texas RHH. And finally, all that matters at the end of the day, because every single cause of action requires proof of damages and proof of legally recognizable damages, and Maxis suffered none. whether the lien had been paid off and released the day of closing or whether it was paid off the day after is, at the end of the day, really irrelevant because the evidence is conclusive that Maxis never paid a dime to the IRS. Therefore, it had no injury. That was a net.
Well, what about the appellee's argument here that because of the way the balance sheet was structured, had everything been disclosed with the full penalties and interest and all that, it would have affected the retained earnings number? Do you disagree with that?
I do disagree with that, but again, at the end of the day, that doesn't matter.
But wouldn't that have affected how much they would have paid for the assets?
It would not have, Your Honor, because the letter of intent was off, and in 9 days before the actual closing date, Maxis came back to Ms. Brady and it said, "What would it take to sell?" And she said, $8.8 million. If they had not given her in Texas RHH $8 million, I see my time is out. May I briefly come? Then there would have simply been no jail. Thank you.
Counselors, we appreciate your argument today. It's been very helpful. Your case has been submitted, and you are free to go, or you're free to stay or listen to the next argument, but we're going to have a panel change in the meantime.